Yes, and this is KOOP, Austin, Texas, 91.7 on your effing dial. We're so glad we had this time together.
We're very glad.
Yes, this is Taylor Cage.
And this is Crash all the way from London via Hammersmith, Piccadilly Line, westbound, mind the gap, please, something like that.
Something like that. So I tell you what, we're going to be calling up our pals. And on the phone, we have this massive phone conference.
Amazing.
With some people who are behind the re-release of this wonderful Paul Delph album, A God That Can Dance. And gentlemen, could you introduce yourselves?
And ladies.
And ladies. Yes. All right. Cool.
Right. We're including everybody.
There you go. and those wannabes. Yes.
Let's see where to start. I'm Andy Markley. I'm calling in from Sacramento, California.
Wow.
I'm Paul Marcus, calling in from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I'm Doug Lund, calling in from Santa Monica.
I'm Vita Vieira, calling in from Santa Monica.
All right. Well, it sounds like we've got such a full studio, and it's just me and Crash. This
exactly. It's happy days here.
I know. I was saying earlier, this is like having a party, but you don't have to clean up the house.
I know. But you can't send someone else to make the, you know, to make the drinks. You got to go get them yourself. It's so sad.
You got to figure out how to do this at home.
Well, let's talk about this wonderful project that y'all have done. You're in the midst of re-releasing all of maybe not all, because he's done so much work, and it's Paul Delph, but I know that this is only the first of some albums that will be re-released on CD format.
Well, that's the plan. Those listeners who aren't familiar with Paul's work can see an amazing list of musicians that Paul worked with at the website pauldelph.com, and there's the first plug for the website. That's PAULDELPH.com. Paul worked with, I don't know, think of a name that you've heard on the radio, and Paul Delph probably had something to do with that project.
Well, of course, one that is near and dear to all queer wavers is Two Tons of Fun.
It's Raining Men.
There you go. He did the production work for that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh my, yes. Gosh, believe it or not, I couldn't find my copy. So we'll just pause for a second and let everyone play that in their heads for about 5 seconds.
That and Nikki.
Oh my Nikki, gosh, yeah. Nikki. Oh, I could have brought Tony Basil if only I'd thought. Oh gosh, and he's so fine, he blows my mind. And yes. And Andy, how are you working with this group, with this re-release?
I'm just a conduit for this stuff. I'm on the periphery. The others in this call, they go back way further than I do with both Paul and Jimmy. But I seem to be the guy who, I don't know, I do websites for dead rock people.
The dead rockers.
That seems to be my role.
That's why I can't get a website.
There you go. What can you say? Well, you know, it's nice to know. who to go to.
Are you a rock star? Are you dead? Call me. Sorry, I really don't mean to be flip. I mean, but that's my role in this. I just acted as a conduit for it. All this stuff.
Well, and you were connected with Jimmy and Paul as friends, and also, you know, were hanging around us musically when we were doing various things, and we're always sort of a part of it, and then you picked up the banner.
And Paul and I were working on some stuff, too. I mean, things of mine, and Paul and I produced an album for a British artist named Graham Grace, and I've been to the Magic Bus, the studio where a lot of this stuff was done.
And how about the rest of y'all? How are you, have y'all been involved?
Well, Doug, you and Vita met Paul and Jimmy before I did.
Doug talking. Paul and I were partners. I met Paul in July 1980, mm-hmm. and we became partners. We had a band called Zoo Drive for 7 years. did a million albums, everyone's album but our own.
I don't think I was even born back then.
Paul was one of my major keyboard musical partners and collaborators for all the 80s. And then even after that, for the years, he was always, when he and Vita and I worked together on a lot of projects, we started a band called Deja Voodoo together. And for he and Vita, they were major partners during this time.
80s bands had the best names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who could resist a name like Carter Gugu? Men at work. Men at work. All right. Right.
Well, I met. This is Paul speaking. I met 2 weeks after I moved to L.A. The guy I was rooming with said, "There's this guy Jimmy Spheeris who needs a replacement for his keyboard player to go out on a gig." And I went and met with Jimmy and Paul. Paul was this young, I guess, 24-year-old. He was or 20-year-old. He's probably 20. Mm-hmm. You know, amazing keyboard player. And I was supposed to take his place, and I was totally intimidated. I went out on this tour with Jimmy, who missed Paul the entire time, and missed his playing. But that, I got to know them that way, and then Paul and I ended up connecting and forming a band. I became Zoo Drive's number one fan, and then I got a project going myself. It was a synthesizer project called All Waves, and very close to the title of your show. And Paul and I were kind of a duo synthesizer band, and we went out and toured with Jimmy, backed Jimmy up sometimes by ourselves and sometimes with the Zoo.
Was that some of the stuff that when you opened for Moody Blues? And
yeah, Jimmy Hale got all these. He didn't even have a record deal anymore, and he still got these national tours with the Moody Blues. And so we were just the three of us opening up for them, and it was a lot of fun. And so I got to know. I started writing songs. I was more of the songwriter, co-songwriter with Jimmy and Paul than I was the player. And the Zoo Drive were the amazing musicians that did amazing stuff with both Paul and Jimmy.
Well, what is it about Paul's music? Now, this is okay. Here comes the softball question. Okay, what is it about Paul's music that made all of y'all get together and want to see the music re-released?
It just had to be done. It was just astonishing. It's astonishing work. It's an amazing album. It's there's an incredible lineup of musicians. The material is just stunning. It was languishing, and it just this stuff needs to be documented and preserved and made available to a new generation of listeners. It had to be done.
The thing about Paul, I mean, that for the people that knew him and close, that in a just universe, Paul would have been a global pop star. Paul should have been known like Sting or David Bowie or any of these people like that. Paul had the stuff. I mean, everyone around him at the time just looked and went, "Oh, him! He, you know, you could just see it. He was, you know, he was made for this kind of thing." And we all couldn't believe when. I mean, it's hard seeing someone like that go through the career and be so close and never get the recognition. And just you don't want them to disappear without a trace. You just when it happens, you just go, "This is someone we know. This person. He's a friend of ours, and he should be known. It's important that people that the work has a life."
I want to add something to that because not only do we recognize this charisma that he had, and as Doug says, in a just universe, he should have been recognized. But one of the reasons that didn't happen was because he spent so much of his time helping others get there.
It's true.
You know, and he wanted his friends to make it, and he would do everything in his power to make it happen for you to realize your music. So I think in the spirit of that, I see Andy and the rest of us wanting him to be recognized because he gave so much to each and every one of us personally, of his life force, of his time, of his abilities, and of his dreams.
So the A God That Can Dance, it was finished just before he died?
Yes.
Yeah, Paul and I worked closely on that, and we had been writing songs for like 15 years, and found out he was positive, and then finally told me. Slowly but surely, we started looking at it. We were writing these songs that were sort of a song cycle, and we didn't really realize that until we were about halfway through. But it was basically documenting what he went through, mm-hmm. and what we were going through, and so it was, you know, it was very exciting and incredibly sad and always powerful what was happening, that all the recording that went on in that during those sessions. And most of it happened in this magic bus. There was this, somebody had left this 24-track recording studio in a bus in Malibu and said, "Paul, here, you can use this." You know, he just came up with amazing, amazing stuff. I remember when he wrote "Mama, Don't Cry," it came out of a conversation where I said, "You've got to tell your folks. You've got to tell them," because he wanted to protect them. Like, because that's just—he's a sweet guy that doesn't want anybody to hurt. Mm-hmm. he did, and that sort of one of his ways of telling his mom was to write the song, and man.
Hmm. One thing that I've noticed, especially, well, not just with this album of his, but with the album that he produced of Jimmy's, that he doesn't really, oh gosh, what can I say? The production values don't date the material. Right. I mean, it just sounds
true.
Jimmy's album Spiris sounds like it could have been, like it could be released, like you'd be listening to it at the Tower sound system.
Absolutely. You listen to any of the tracks on that album, and they could have been recorded yesterday.
And the same with Paul's album. I guess I find that so much more remarkable with Jimmy's, because that's 20 years ago, and it still sounds fresh.
One of the things I always loved about Paul's approach to recording, he was always so meticulous and careful about the kinds of sounds that he chose. It's really tempting to use the trendy sound digital sample that's happening right now. And Paul sort of stayed away from that. The things that he did are timeless.
Especially like I keep pointing it out, you know, going back to it, I guess, because it's so easy. The 80s sounds, I mean, in Jimmy's album, there wasn't the electronic keyboard, there wasn't the saxophone solo, there wasn't, you know, everything that I associate with an 80s song, you know, with 80s pop.
Right.
And even so much so with his own album, it's just remarkable. But then again, think about... Two Tons of Fun, It's Raining Men. I mean, my God, you know?
Just think about it.
You know, just, okay, I will. Yeah, okay. There. Oh, gosh. I'm thinking about it right now. Okay.
Hallelujah.
But my God, that, you know, that could be on the VH1 new release, you know? God.
Mm-hmm. I know.
It should be.
I think Andy sent you a copy of Roadblock.
We're waiting to download. We had computer problems.
Well, anyway, it's actually Zoo Drive, and that whole band were very, very adventurous musically, individually and together. And Paul brought that adventurous, along with being meticulous. He was also very adventurous and spontaneous and incredibly intuitive. So he would just come up with stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether it's writing or what when we were producing it, it was like he just play some. And it just came out. I mean, that's what was one of the amazing things about him, is he had this wizardry that he brought to the table that's where the timelessness comes from.
Watching him work at the board when he was mixing and recording stuff was impossible to get a clear, focused photograph of the guy. He was moving around as fast as the electrons he was shoving through all those wires.
Incredible sound he has.
Yeah, it's an amazing odyssey through his final months. We were all of us just sort of shut up. We're all like, you know, hypnotized by this work.
Isn't it incredible?
Great to hear it. And great to hear it on the radio.
Go to pauldelph.com.